Good evening. This is the NLA Hamps Net. I am Terry from Colorado. My call sign is KI0RE. You can look that up on QRZ.com and see who I am. We have the NLA Hamps Net every week on Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on this conference call. Anybody's welcome to join in to the conversation, and we're talking about anything that has to do with NLA or hams. So, with that said, does anybody have any questions or anything they wanted to talk about this week or get clarification on or suggest or criticism or whatever? Please call now.
No questions.
Okay, so we'll press on from there. If anybody needs to ask a question, just pipe up and ask, and we'll try and accommodate it. We have been going through the ARRL manual. We're up to Chapter 4, Propagation Antenna and Feed Lines. Maybe we'll finish talking on propagation today, but I'm just going to walk through some of the text. I underlined some stuff, and so anyway, propagation is how well your radio signal goes out to other places. How radio waves get from one place to another. The more you learn about propagation, the more effective you'll be operating your antenna and even building antennas. Just like light, imagine a lighthouse that's circling around, only it's not like that because it goes in every direction. It's more like a big light that you can see from any direction all at once. Radio waves spread out from an antenna in straight lines unless reflected or diffracted along the way, just like light. Light waves are just a very, very, very high frequency of form of radio waves. Like light, the strength of a radio wave decreases as it travels further from the transmitting antenna, inverse square law. Eventually, the wave becomes too weak to be received because it has spread out too much or something along its path absorbed or scattered it. The distance over which a radio transmission can be received is called range. Excuse me. The range is how far is this signal going to travel, and it depends on a lot of things. The curvature of the Earth sets an effective range limit for many signals, creating a radio horizon. Something good to know. Line of sight propagation, and that's what we've been talking about mainly. I've mentioned it many times. Between transmitting and receiving antennas that are within direct sight of one of each other. Now, just because you can see something doesn't mean you can reach it. If I stand on a hill over here on Long's Peak and try to reach another 14er, say Pike's Peak, which everybody seems to know about, I may or may not be able to reach it because I just don't have enough oomph to go. So that's one of those things where a better antenna or a little more power would aid in making that connection. Those two places are about, I'd say, roughly 100 miles apart. And if you want to get on Google and prove me wrong, please do so. And let me know what the actual number is. I would be interested to know. Most propagation at VHF and higher frequencies is line of sight. Increasing antenna height or transmitter power also increases the range of line-of-sight propagation. Radio waves at HF and lower frequencies can also travel along the surface of the Earth as ground wave propagation. When you listen to an AM radio station during the day, you're getting ground wave propagation. At night, when you're a long ways from it, when it fades in and fades back out, you're getting skip. You're getting a skywave station. And also you'll notice that the FCC sets up some particular stations. Here in Colorado we have KOA. It's on 850. In Fort Worth they have WBAP. Those are Skyway stations. Their frequency is set, and nobody else around the country, or maybe a long ways off, like 2,000 or more miles away. On a good night, KOA is hitting about 38 states. WBAP is hitting a similar number, but mostly there's a lot of those in New Mexico. So it can happen. The radio waves can be reflected by any sudden change in the media through which they are traveling, such as a building, a hill, or even weather-related changes in the atmosphere. Obstructions such as buildings and hills create radio shadows, especially at VHF and UHF frequencies. You go up a canyon here in Colorado, unless you have something that's listening down that canyon, you don't hear it. And you don't receive the station, and it's pretty hard to get out. Then again, on some of the more popular canyons, like the I-70 corridor through the mountains, they've got different repeaters that you can hit from at different places along there, and then you can talk and carry on a conversation, which I've done. Let's see. Figure 4.1 shows how radio waves can also be diffracted as they travel past sharp edges of these objects. This is called knife edge propagation. Refraction is another type of propagation, a gradual bending of VHF and UHF radio waves in the atmosphere. By bending signals slightly back towards the ground, refraction counteracts the curvature of the Earth to an extent and allows signals at these frequencies to be received at distances somewhat beyond the visual line of sight horizons. Radio waves can also penetrate openings and solid objects that can do many other things. Figure 4-1 on top of page 4-2 shows what knife edge propagation looks like. It shows the signal hitting that knife edge, and of course the signal at that point wants to go as if that point was radiating itself, and so it goes out in different ways, and sometimes you get a shadow. Shorter wavelengths of UHF signals make them more effective propagating into and out of buildings in the urban areas. This is why they use a higher frequency inside towns. Oftentimes your cell phones are on a much higher frequency. They used to use 800, 900 megahertz. Now they're using 1.2 or 1.4 megahertz. I can't remember. Different paths. Once that radio wave is reflected or refracted, the same signal meets itself kind of in a ghost image and can cancel out part of the signal because it's out of phase. So you have areas of shadow or strong signals, and you just have to get used to what it got. But it leads to something called multipath. Sometimes when you're talking to someone and maybe they're traveling, they're bouncing off something and they're bouncing off another thing, and those two waves are getting messed up, and you'll hear them go in and out or just chatter as they go down. You'll get every other word, and that's multipathing. It interferes with itself. You can also get a rapid variation in strength known as mobile flutter or picket fencing. That's another form of multipathing. Let's see. Different layers of the atmosphere can have a tremendous effect on things. If you have a cold layer on top of a hot layer, when that's stable, it can act like a mirror and extend your range. Also, we can get into the different layers of the atmosphere. So the ionosphere, if you think about it, at the lower atmosphere where air is relatively dense and below outer space, where there isn't any air at all, lies the ionosphere. In this region, from about 30 to 260 miles above the Earth, atoms of oxygen and nitrogen gas, which is what most of our atmosphere is, are exposed to the intense and energetic ultraviolet rays of the sun. These rays, here, I better turn off my radio. I've been getting ready for a support of Bike MX here in 2 weeks, and I've got to program up my radios with everything and review all the documentation for the communications plan that we're going up, so I have been doing that today. So the gas, oxygens, and nitrogens, they get some electrons knocked off, which makes some positive ions, and the rays have enough energy to create positively charged ions from the gas atoms by knocking off some of the electrons. I said that. Excuse me. I'm reading again. The resulting ions and electrons create a weakly conducting region high above the Earth. The ionosphere forms in layers, as shown in Figure 4.2. Looking at that, the top picture on Figure 4.2 shows the ionosphere is just a region, and then it breaks down the ionosphere into the above the stratosphere, the D layer, the E layer, the two F layers, and the F layer is the one that during the day, you have an F1 and an F2 layer. At night, F1 and F2 combine, and you just have one F layer up there. And it has different properties during the day and during the night. Different frequencies work better at night. Different other frequencies work better during the day. And it just all depends on what you're using and where you're trying to reach. When a radio wave, HF, sometimes VHF, because when you're getting up into 50 megahertz or above 30 megahertz, you're actually talking about the lower portion of the VHF band. And so some of that can act like an HF radio and the signal get reflected. Also, if you get some temperature inversions and some extra things. I've heard of people in California talking to people in Hawaii, excuse me, because of sporadic E. If you look up sporadic dash capital E, you will find a bunch about it on the internet, and there's actually maps you can look at to show where sporadic E connections have been made. It's totally controlled by the atmosphere, but you just got to know when to look and what the conditions are. And then you can talk to somebody that you've never talked to before, way different from the line of sight. It's a lot of fun, and some people, they love it. They love it. Okay, when a radio wave goes out, the curvature of the Earth tends to bend away from the radio signal, which is going out in a straight line, and it will hit one of those layers. And those layers will, because they're charged, they will conduct it and move around a little bit, and actually part of that wave will be bent back down towards the ground. And since the ground can also act as a conductor, sometimes they'll get bounced and do the whole thing again. And you can actually, in some conditions, talk all the way back around to yourself, and I've discussed that before, and hear yourself like a quick echo on the back side of your antenna. It's a pretty amazing once you can see that happen. It's disarming at first, but a hop is going up and coming down back to the Earth. And the hop can be at different distances. A hop at one distance on one frequency will be different from another hop on a different frequency because of the way the radio waves propagate. And this is called skip. And sometimes I've seen stories on TV where part of the reason of the story was a guy working a radio just off the coast or maybe a little back in heard a distress signal. And he wanted to report it, and they didn't believe him until he got the right person who understood what was happening. So a ship in the right place could be transmitting a distress signal, and it could bounce off the stratosphere and bounce all the way beyond the Coast Guard listening station near the coast. This has happened before in real life, and you just need to be aware of it. Let's see here.
A question?
Yes.
This is KC3HVA. To add an old-time comment there, you're talking about Skip and stuff. I was raised in north central Iowa, and we had a local TV station, KGLO, in Mason City, Iowa. I believe it was Channel 3. And then I moved to Connecticut, which was about 1,500 miles away.
I'm sorry.
It was about 1,500 miles away. And in those days, this was like 1960 to 65, we had antennas for TV, not little dishes. We put them on posts on top of the house and things like that. And they had a rotator on them, so you could rotate around to pick up signals from different stations in different areas around the country, mostly local, within 50 to 100 miles. One night I was sitting there and I rotated around to the west, which was not the direction for my Channel 3 in Connecticut. And lo and behold, I picked up Channel 3 in Mason City, Iowa. Now, I thought that was absolutely amazing for a frequency like that, TV frequency, to be picked up that far away. And I rotated around full circle and I picked up two other Channel 3s. So it was a very weird propagation night, to say the least. Over.
Well, thank you, Jan. Good input. Oftentimes when the conditions are right, you don't know what you'll see. And I think I commend you for trying to look around for other Channel 3s and finding the others. Because if it was working for one, it might be working for another. And this ionization thing, I want you to know that there are other people who bounce signals off of anything they can. They'll bounce it off the moon. They'll bounce it off meteor trails, which is a very strongly ionized piece of atmosphere. And they actually make contact like that with different places all over the world at different times, but you got to have a meteor to do it, of course, to do it. So they have different ways of doing that. You can investigate it. I'm not going to go into it here. I would like to go into the next page, 4-4, and look at figure 4.3. And the reason is that it shows three types of signals. Frequency too low, it's absorbed. So the frequency was too low, and the ionosphere just flat absorbed it. And then a frequency too high, and it just kept going right on going through the atmosphere. And then right in between a too low and a too high, then you get a bending, and it goes for a long ways. And like I say, depending upon what the frequency is and what those conditions are, you could be talking to somewhere across the country, or somebody halfway across the world, depending upon what the conditions are. The highest frequency signal that can be reflected back to a point on Earth, the one that gets reflected, is the maximum usable frequency, or MUF, and some people call it the MUF, between the transmitter and receiver. The lowest usable frequency, the lowest frequency that can travel between these points without having being absorbed, is the lowest usable frequency, or the LUF. And then they talk about illustrating that in figure 4.3. Well, I want you to know that those are published. You can find them on the internet every day, depending upon what the sunspot activity is. because the sunspots, since they push out lots more UV rays, have a tendency to really charge up the atmosphere with a positive charge, because they're knocking off and ionizing. They're knocking off electrons off of oxygen and nitrogen and ionizing the atmosphere up there at the ionosphere from 30 to 260 miles. As sunspot activity increases, the more intense solar UV rays become, this increases the peak level of ionization in the ionosphere, raising the MUF along the path between stations. During the years of maximum solar activity, the upper HF bands, such as 10 meters, are likely to be open between dawn and shortly after sunset. Occasionally, the F layers can even reflect 6 meters, which is 50 megahertz in the VHF band, signals at the sunspot cycle's peak. When skyway propagation on an amateur band is possible between two points, the band is said to be open. And this is a little bit of lingo. A band is open when two parties can exchange information and being able to communicate. They consider it that band is open. If not, the band is closed. Because the ionosphere depends on solar radiation to form, areas in daylight have a different ionosphere above them than those in nighttime areas. That means radio propagation may be supported in some directions, but not others. Opening and closing to different locations as the Earth rotates and seasons change. This makes pursuing long-distance contacts, or DXing is what they call that, very interesting. And there's a lot of people that live for DXing. And they also go to different islands. You'll see what's called a DXpedition. A DXpedition, which means they go into a remote place that hams don't operate from very often, like some obscure island in the island chain that's out south of South America, or out in the Caribbean, or wherever. And this island might only have, it might be 1 square mile, but they set up an antenna, they get all this equipment there, and then they operate from there and say, we're at such and such an island. I used to have a poster of a guy that went down to where the penguins were on an island off the coast of Antarctica, and they operated for a week or 2 weeks on different bands, doing it, communicating with everybody they could. And everybody they could communicate with, they would fill out a card and acknowledge that communication and send it back to, back to that person. And that's the thing about ham radio. If you're going to get your license, you're going to be putting down your current address. You can't use post office box. And that address is in a public database that anybody can look up. You can look up me, KI0RE, Kilo India, Zero Romeo Echo. And you can see who I am and where I live, but that's about all. And that's so they have some idea as to where a particular call sign is transmitting from. Well, if you make a contact, one of these DX positions, they take down your call sign. And when they get back, they put it in their log. And when they get back, they process all that information of who made contact and send out these little what's called a QSO card. A QSO stands for a discussion or a communication between two people. And people send your QSO cards. You get a card from that island and their DXpedition, and it's really cool. And there's hams that they use those cards to decorate their ham shack, and they've got walls of them. Walls. As a note, one time, I went to D.C. I went with my family, and we were down in the Smithsonian. And I said, ooh, who runs this radio? Oh, we have hams come in on this day and this day. And I said, well, we're having a special station on the first week in September. And I gave him the date. I forget which what it was. And it's Bart Jr.'s. We're going to be trying to get as many contacts. And they said that they would communicate to the ham. So the day came, and Bart Jr. was operating under the call sign W0W, which stands for WOW. And it was just trying to operate to encourage people and kids to jump on. We actually let certain kids jump on. And during that time, that afternoon, lo and behold, the Smithsonian Institute, at that ham station I was at, the ham said, this is so-and-so, I forget the call sign. And he sent us a QSO card with his information on it. And it was wonderful to see the kids light up to get that experience. And it's really cool. So there we go. Now, where was I? DXing. DXing goes on and on and on. VHF and UHF enthusiasts also experience exciting ionospheric propagation. When solar radiation becomes sufficiently intense, such as during the peak of the 11-year sunspot cycle, the F layers of the ionosphere can bend VHF signals back to Earth. When those ham bands open, they support long-distance communications not possible in normal conditions. In addition, at all points in the solar cycle, patches of the ionosphere's E-layer can become sufficiently ionized to reflect UHF and VHF signals back to Earth. This is called sporadic E. That's what I was talking about, or E-skipped. Or they write it E-subscript S. And it's most common during early summer and midwinter months on 10, 6, and 2 meters. So you might even get something on 2 meters, which, as a technician, you can use all three of those bands if you get your license. Along with sporadic E propagation, the ionosphere is home to other radio wave reflectors. The aurora, northern lights, is the glow from the sheets of charged particles flowing down through the lower layers of the ionosphere. Those thin ion sheets, 50 miles or more above the Earth's surface, reflect VHF and UHF signals. Because the aurora is constantly changing, the reflected signals can change strength quickly and are often distorted. This region of the ionosphere is also home to meteor trails, and I mentioned that while ago. A meteoroid burning up in the upper atmosphere results in meteor or meteor trail of an ionized gas lighting up to several seconds that can reflect radio signals. Bouncing signals off these ionized trail is called meteor scatter propagation. The best band for meteor scatter is 6 meters, and contacts can be made at distances up to 1,200 to 1,500 miles. Okay. How we doing on time? We got about 15 minutes left. Are there any questions? I'll stop right here. I'll pause because I don't want to just be talking to myself. I hope it's useful for somebody. I had one person call me and said it was useful for her, but she was outside during this time, and she can only enjoy the programs by listening to the recordings. So thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I hope others gain some of this from their times listening to recordings. Are there any questions, suggestions, outright criticisms, or anything? I'll give you about 5-10 seconds here. Go ahead. Call now.
This is KC3HVA. There are a lot of similarities between propagation of sound in the ocean and propagation of radio waves, and looking at figure 4-3, it's interesting to note that if the frequency is too low, the radio wave is absorbed in the layer, and if it's too high, it just runs straight through. On the higher the frequency for sonar or acoustic propagation, the larger the attenuation or absorption by the water column, so that the low frequencies travel best for long ranges. Also, on the ocean, they have a gradient, you might call it, where the velocity varies from the surface to the bottom. Then there's two major effects. One is the pressure effect. So the deeper you go, the higher the pressure, the more the sound increases. And the second one is the effect of temperature. Now, the surface of the ocean is its hottest point normally, and it gradually decreases as you go down until you get to 500 or 1,000 feet, and then it kind of stays stable near 32 degrees. So what happens is you get sound that is maximum at the surface. It decreases at some depth. It's called the minimum sound speed axis, and then it increases again to the bottom. So if you go down to that depth and you put a source at that depth and let it propagate at all angles, it'll travel right down the center of that axis, and it'll go great distances in the ocean, maybe thousands of miles. So that is called a SOFAR channel for sound frequency and ranging. And if you have down flyers, which you might know about, Terry, over the ocean, I don't know if they carried a little SOFAR charge, which you dropped, and it's set programmed to go off at a certain depth where the deep sound channel axis is. And that will go off and transmit in all directions and be picked up by receivers around the edge of the oceans, and you can triangulate and find out where that airplane or person went down, and also it gives you some assurance that they survived whatever happened to them. Another interesting thing about sonar is you can get cases where you have like isovelocity water, and it might extend from the surface down to a few hundred feet. If you start a ray propagating horizontally, it'll just go infinitely in range until it's absorbed through absorption. If you shoot it up or down a little bit, it'll go till it hits a boundary and reflect off like a billiard ball and come back down and hit the bottom of the layer and reflect again, come back up. So that energy is trapped in that layer pretty well. So there's a lot of similarities, but some differences too. Over.
Wow, I didn't know all that. Jan, that's really good. Thank you. I appreciate that. So there's a lot of things you can do, and you can think of some of them have a rough correlation between what you can do in the ocean with sound and what you can do in the air with radio frequencies. And no, I did not know that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just agreeing with you. There are an awful lot of correlations.
Yeah, there are a lot of correlations. And, you know, we're still learning. And that's the thing about amateur radio, is you can act as an experimenter and be looking for these things. So it's kind of fun to explore new ways to communicate. And I'd like to mention something here. I'm about to start antenna fundamentals. I don't know how far we'll get, but this first paragraph speaks volumes. An antenna is not necessarily something that you must purchase or that looks like a commercial product. Any electrical conductor can act as an antenna for radio signals. A wire, a pipe, a car body, or even the proverbial bed springs. Now, what they're talking about that is in the 30s, people didn't have a whole lot of money, and ham radio was just getting started. It had been around a little while, but it was beginning to be regulated by the FCC. And people would do things like they had some old bed springs sitting out in the yard of the farm, and so they'd try to attach a lead to that and send out some radio waves. Now, the radio transmitters weren't very sophisticated at that time. They were getting there. So a lot of them, they actually use bed springs to talk back and forth. And that's been kind of a myth or an old wives' tale or an old ham's tale. And it's possible. It probably somebody has tried it because a lot of people have tried a lot of things. There are places that do not allow an antenna. And what will happen is that if you, I've heard many people say this, if you have metal gutters, they tie one of their lines to a metal gutter. And if they tinker with it just a little bit, they get the right spot on the gutter. The gutter acts like a great big antenna, and nobody can tell that you're transmitting out of that. I've heard people that go for, they go on trips, but they like doing Morse code, and so while they're out, if they can find a hotel that has windows they can open, they hang a line, a wire, a random wire, down a ways that's cut to a certain length. And they hook that as their antenna off of their feed line. And they talk all over the world with that. Anything that conducts electricity potentially can be used as an antenna. But remember what I said. Everything has a resonant frequency. But even if you're not on that resonant frequency, sometimes you can get a harmonic or some other kind of different property, and you can actually use everyday objects as antennas, like bed springs, like cars, and lots of other stuff. I've also seen wires that were just a foot off the top of the house, and if anybody asks, that's their lightning rod. They're trying horizontal lightning rods, but at night, they talk all over the world on it, so... you don't see that as much as you used to, but there's still people who experiment because radio amateur radio is an experimental type of hobby, and everybody's trying all kinds of different things.
Yeah, I have
go ahead.
A comment, if you don't mind. Your horizontal lightning rod reminded me of some Amish friends of mine, and they were a little... bit advanced, and they like to listen to music on the radio, God forbid. And they found that they could take the antenna for the radio, stretch it out, and they had a mount underneath the car for it. And they were able to get enough signal there, even horizontally, so that they could listen to the radio. However, one day the bishop caught them listening to the radio and figured out what was going on. So they had to take the radio out of the car and the antenna with it. So, but like you say, people are very inventive when it comes to getting an antenna up there.
I also know a guy who likes to hike, but he also likes to take his radio with him and talk. So he's hiking by himself out in the woods across wherever he lives, and he trails an antenna. A wire that's cut to the right length and it's insulated, so it has a coating on it, you know, like a rubber coating, like many wires that you see. He puts that behind him, and he does Morse code as he walks around doing and has conversations with people all around the world while he's hiking out in the wilderness. Anything can act as an antenna. You just got to be careful and make it reasonable, and you can actually load it up and do it. You can actually blow your radio out too if you try and put too much power into it if it's a bad antenna. Because most cars don't make a good antenna because they make a good ground plane, but they don't make a good antenna. The thing going to an antenna is a feed line. It's used to deliver the radio signals to and from the antenna. The connection of an antenna and feed line is called the feed point of the antenna. Just like Ohm's law in Chapter 2, the ratio of radio frequency voltage to current at an antenna's feed point is the antenna's feed point impedance. And we talked a little bit about impedance. I encourage each of you to take a look and look up impedance and try to understand what it is. And there's two aspects to impedance, inductive impedance and capacitive impedance. And you kind of need to know about those. When you're building an antenna, it's much more effective if you cut the radials or the aerials or whatever you're using to a certain length that relates to either a quarter or halfway dipole for a particular frequency. And this is all in the book, and you can figure it out, and it's not at this point, but I thought I would mention it there. You want, if depending upon how long something is, lots of times determines what frequency it'll work best on. So keep that in mind. An antenna's feed point impedance is at a specific frequency, depends on how its physical dimensions compare to the wavelength at that frequency. Feed point impedance changes with frequency because wavelength changes, but the physical dimensions don't. An antenna's feed point impedance is also affected by nearby conductors and its height above ground. The conducting portions of an antenna by which the radio signals are transmitted or received are called elements. So you've seen TV antennas, and maybe you've seen ham antennas, and they look flat. And there's rows of horizontal tubes. They're all parallel. Those tubes are cut to a specific ratio of the frequency. This probably the center of the band, or maybe it's tuned down or tuned up to a different frequency. The idea is that you just got to get close in a lot of them. And a poor antenna is actually better than no antenna at all in making it work. But elements are those rods that are horizontal rods on different parts of the antenna. An antenna with more than one element is called an array. The element connected to the feed line is called the driven element. And these are important terms that I would encourage you to learn. If all the elements are connected to a feed line, that's a driven array. And I've seen some of those. There's a guy down in Houston or near Houston that does EME, Earth, Moon, Earth. He bounces signals off of the moon and talks to people that way. And he has these large arrays, and they're all driven. Elements that are not directly connected to a feed line, but that influence the antenna performance, are called parasitic elements. RF current in an antenna element creates radio waves that travel away from the antenna. The radio wave is composed of both electrical and magnetic energy supplied by the electrons moving back and forth in the antenna. The wave is a combination of an
I wasn't muted, and that was my dryer buzzer.
Oh, good. The wave is a combination of electric and magnetic field, just like the fields in a capacitor and inductor, but spreading out into space like ripples traveling across the surface of water. Because a radio wave is made up of both types of fields, it is called an electromagnetic wave. And there's where you get the name for electromagnetic waves. It has both components. All waves do. All RF energy does. All electromagnetic waves do. The waves' electric and magnetic fields oscillate at the same frequency as the RF current in the antenna. And I'm going to wrap it up right there because I'm just about out of time. I would encourage you to take a look at the book, and we'll pick it up there next week. Does anybody have any closing comments or remarks, suggestions or criticisms? Please call now. This has been the NLA Hams Net. We talk about things NLA-ish and Hamish, and we're very glad for you to be here. Thank you to everyone who's listening and those of you that listen to the recording later on. My name is Terry from Colorado. My call sign is KI0RE. You can look it up on QRZ, which is QRZ.com. This net is held every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time or Eastern Time. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful for the participation I got tonight. Especially Jan, and I call the net is now closed.